You're listening to Cattails. Hi, this is Kat, and welcome to another edition of Cattails. Today on the line, I'm joined by drummer Bob Henrit, who has quite a few tales to tell. Ivor Novello Award winner and Hall of Fame inductee, Bob has been a member of The Roulettes, Unit 4 Plus 2, Argent, The Kinks and Almost Genesis, as well as recording with Leo Sayer, Ringo Starr and Roger Daltrey. And it isn't over yet. This is The One with Bob Henrit.
Hello, Bob.
Hello, Kat.
Whereabouts are you, down in Hertfordshire?
I grew up in Waltham Cross. It's sort of where we all grew up, Chas, me, Russ Ballard, a great many others, Cliff Richard even. We grew up in a place called Waltham Cross, which became a sort of hive of activity musically.
Yeah.
And it was centred around Chesant Boys Club, which we were all members of.
Wow.
And so we would be, I think we paid 1 and 6 a year to be a member of the Boys Club and get free rehearsal space as often as we wanted it, which was a bit of a bargain.
Crikey. And how old would you have been at this time then, Bob?
How old? 13, 14, 15.
Oh, wow.
I was with Russ Ballard in a band from the time that we became teenagers. We drift back together again every now and again. Of course, we were in Argent together, and we were in Unit 4 Plus 2 together, and we played with Adam Faith's Roulettes together.
A lot of these relationships then go back a long time with you, don't they? They've started off very young, and then you've actually followed quite a lot of those relationships through your musical career.
Well, we've done our best. I mean, I haven't seen Chas for a while, but I will bump into him, God willing, every now and again. I see Mike Berry from time to time. We're all of an age when we like to actually get together.
It's nice, isn't it?
Although it's not. Well, I mean, the Roulettes do a get together every now and again, and it's very nice. We go for an Indian, or we're going for a pizza, or we go for anything really. And we guess what we talk about?
Music, probably.
Sometimes music, but mostly grandkids and gardens.
Yes. Well, that's what life is, though, isn't it? Which is so wonderful. You know, it's not all about the career, is it?
No, but it was a little bit incestuous at the time, because we would all be swapping bands, if you like. I mean, I would play with Mike Berry, and Mike Berry's drummer would play with the band I was in, and I'd play with Chas, of course. And that was how it went on. We saw no end to that. And then we did drift apart a bit, because the world at that time was a big place. It's not a big place anymore. It's not, you know, going to LA isn't a big deal it used to be.
No, that's right.
Still takes time.
Yes,
but it's certainly not the big deal of going to Australia.
No, not like it used to be, did it? So you've obviously travelled these far-off places, have you, as part of your career over the years then, have you, Bob?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing about being a musician, is that you have to travel or to be a successful musician. And if you don't like travelling, then perhaps music's not for you, because it involves a lot of travel. Charlie Watts says that he's been in the Stones for 40 years, was 10 years playing and 30 years hanging about.
That's probably very true.
Which, of course, is about it's about what sums it up. And funnily enough, I've always been fascinated by travel. So as soon as my first aeroplane I got on took me to Australia, and which was quite, and that was with my brand new passport and with Adam Faith. I was nearly 17, I think. I think we had to get permission to go, I'm not sure. And that was my first journey. And then after that, I was hooked. It took us 45 hours to get there.
Wow, that's incredible,
and
isn't it?
The plane was stopping at places like Rome to fill up with petrol. It's crazy. Anyway, it went on. And then I have a wanderlust, as indeed my grandfather had a wanderlust, and I think my kids have got a bit of a wanderlust in them. And I started taking notes and looking out the window and seeing what was there, and it went from there. So the next book is called On the Road Again, and that's about we used to, with Russ Ballard and his brother, we used to take the piano downstairs from their house, put it on the back of his dad's open lorry, and drive off to gigs. And we'd, wow. we'd throw tarpaulins over the top of it. We'd all stand on the back of the lorry, oh. and we'd go off to gigs. So that's how it all began. So the whole adventure has been going on for, well, since we were 13 or 14.
Oh, how incredible.
We certainly couldn't drive.
That's incredible, isn't it? And it would be completely different nowadays, wouldn't it, really? First of all, you may not even get those opportunities. But secondly, the travelling experience would be completely different, wouldn't it?
Well, funnily enough, my son's a drummer, and they were offered a gig in Kazakhstan. And I was a bit askance, I think is the word about it. I thought, is this going to happen? And lo and behold, it didn't. But there was a gig there. So it's not the norm anymore, and certainly Kazakhstan isn't the norm.
No.
So the book is about everything that I've seen from the window of a plane or the window of a bus or even a transit van.
Wow, that's incredible. Now, is this your autobiography that you've actually put all this into, or is this a second book? Because I know you've actually written seven books.
No, this is another one.
Wow. So
I'm on my seventh now. I don't seem to be able to stop myself. I write for a drummer's website, and it's specifically for drummers, and I've been writing for it for years and years and years. But I began writing for a magazine called Beat Instrumental, which was so long ago, nobody will remember it. But that was my first thing to do. And then I wrote for Melody Maker, and I just kept writing for magazines about drums, and nobody else was doing that. So all of a sudden, I'd cornered the market. And then I thought, why don't I write a book? And what I wanted to do with the book is to show the kids where I'd been. Because I am a self-confessed absentee father, without a doubt.
Yeah.
You know, I was away, and one of them... Anyway, so that was what I wanted to tell them, what I'd been up to.
Brilliant.
So they were shocked, I think. No, they weren't shocked.
A few revelations in there rather than Bob.
Well, no, I just wanted to tell the story accurately. I mean, I've done a lot in my life, and I wanted, first of all, to remember it, and secondly, to write it down. And funnily enough, Russell Ballard and I have, our careers have paralleled one another, and we've been in bands together for most of our lives. And he started writing a book, and you would think ostensibly that was going to be the same as my book. Mm. But because, you know, we had the same influences, the same friends, we had the same everything, you know.
Yeah.
And we had the boys' club to keep us going, and that, and his turned out to be different to mine. Which, what you can't do when you're writing the book is have a committee decision on what actually happened, because you'll never finish the book if you do that. You can't have all your mates around you, and because everybody has a different view of what happened. And indeed, Keith Moon said to me, never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Love it. No, that's so true, isn't it?
You know,
everybody's got a different perspective on everything, haven't they, really, in their own individual experience, and that's terrific.
Yeah, we're all different. Well, we're all different, and we're all the same, as I think a song once said.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? So if I may just take you back to the beginning of your career then, Bob, you know, you've obviously just said about you all hanging around together and having various friends that, you know, you've gone on to do exciting projects with. But it almost started, didn't it, when you joined a skiffle band, you were introduced by your neighbour and friend Harry Webb, I believe, into Adam's band.
Yeah, Harry was my next door neighbour. Mm. And so skiffle was what was happening, and He was in a band called the Dick Teague Skiffle Group. Yeah. Actually, I'm saying band, but it isn't band. You know, we always talk about, oh, yeah, bands, man. Well, in the 60s, we weren't in bands. We were in groups.
Yes.
Bands were what you got at the local Palais, playing strict tempo music for people to dance to.
Mm.
So we were groups, but everybody says, oh, bands, you know. And, of course, there's the Spice Girls, who were a girl band, evidently.
Yes, which actually they were just really a group. I totally agree. So you obviously knew Harry, Cliff Richard, as everybody will know him now as, of course.
I did. He came over after partition from India and moved in with his uncle and aunt, who lived next door to us, and stayed there for a year or three, and then moved on. But yeah, we rubbed shoulders every now and again. I mean, were he to be down the road and I went in to see him, we would have a chat, which is good.
Have a nice cup of tea together, which is lovely.
Yes, I would think so.
And of course, you were playing with Adam Faith. I mean, obviously a very big name at the time as well, wasn't he? So was Adam big at the time when you actually started playing with him, or did that grow over the 5 years or so that you were with him?
Well, he was monstrous when I joined him.
Right.
And he'd had the John Barry 7 backing him. And funnily enough, I don't know if you know Bobby Graham.
Yeah.
But Bobby Graham was a drummer, and he came from round here, and he was actually in the John Barry 7. But either the John Barry 7 wanted too much money, or Adam Faith didn't want to pay much money. But anyway, the next thing, I was auditioned for the job and got it, and then Russ Ballard joined, and then we went from there. But we were all-round entertainers, which is a rather strange phrase, but we did summer seasons and we did pantomime.
Hmm.
And so that was what we did. And we worked for the army and we did, you know, it was that sort of thing. It was definitely not just doing rock and roll.
Yeah.
So we were moving rock and roll into variety, because the gigs that we did would be variety theatres. And you do them for several months and then you start again and go back to the first variety theatre where you started. So that's what we were doing, and that necessitated a lot of knowledge of songs, because we did something called the Ever Ready Hour, which was on Radio Luxembourg, and we had to go to Luxembourg studios to record it every other week, I think we went, and we started started recording all this stuff, which went out on a Sunday, and in the end, we did so many of them, and we were absolutely going through every song we knew to actually fill the time, because there was so much time to be filled.
Wow.
So that was the sort of thing we did, and we made records, and the Roulettes had hit records or semi-hit records, and Adam Faith had big hit records, and the rest is history.
Yeah. Exciting time that, Bob, I should think, really. And that was a friendship that actually lasted a whole lifetime as well, because I understand when Adam died in 2003, you joined the remaining Roulettes and carried his coffin. Am I right in that?
Well, we carried his coffin, which was a bit of a surprise. Because, well, it wasn't a surprise, obviously, but it was one of those wicker coffins.
Mm.
And they look easy to carry, but it's like carrying a great big laundry basket,
yes.
An unwieldy laundry bag, so it sort of it bends all over the place. So anyway, we did that and felt good about it, and then Michael Parkinson did the eulogy, and he said, before we go any further, he said, I'd like to say how nice it is to see the Roulettes here carrying Adam Faith's coffin. And he said, there can't be many groups from the 60s who are all still alive.
Oh dear.
So we were very grateful for I think that's called the Mo's Used. But he's very accurate there, because you know, groups are sloughing off their,
yeah.
You know, off members every now and again.
Yeah.
It's not easy getting old, you know.
Oh, I know.
Oh, that's another thing. When we were 16 and we were doing Adam Faith, Stevie Winwood was 13, and we used to think, Stevie, that guy's 13. Just listen to what he's doing, and then 60 years later. He is 71 and I'm 73.
Oh.
So we're all, you know, it's like we're catching one another up.
Yeah, the age gap just sort of like reduces, doesn't it, as you get older? And
well, yeah, it absolutely. Yeah, he's the same age as me, I would say.
Yeah. Well, yes, probably. Or maybe even older in terms of his head, you know, it just depends where you are. But no, as your career's unfolded, though, you've had some wonderful opportunities of playing with some great bands. I mean, you mentioned Argent, didn't you, there earlier as well?
Yes.
How did that one come about? Was that was obviously after Adam and your time with him?
Oh yeah, what had happened, Kat? We had gone to France to play with a French singer, a guy called Richard Anthony, who was hugely famous, and so we backed him for quite a few months in going in and out of France and all over Europe, and we'd actually made a record called Concrete and Clay, which was Unit 4 Plus 2.
Yeah.
Oh, and I say we, I'm including Russell in that, Russ Ballard. So we'd made this record, and it had, against all the odds, had sold millions and millions and millions. For which we got paid £5, 15 shillings and sixpence.
Wow.
So the streets aren't always paved with gold. But to cut to the chase, we came back from France and thought, what are we going to do now? Joined Unit 4 Plus 2 and rushed around the country doing a lot of silly things and making records. And eventually, we were at a gig in Basildon? And I looked out and I thought I saw Rod Argent. And then I thought I saw Chris White, who was the bass player in the Zombies. And it was them, and they came over, and they said, do you want to be in our band? It was pretty much like that.
Wow.
Come and listen to the songs. And the songs were fabulous, and we said, yeah, let's do it. So instead of doing the Zombies, the Zombies had just had a hit in America with Time of the Season,
yeah.
And the album was doing very well, but Rod decided he wanted to do something different and was going to do something different and wanted to push the envelope and have a much more progressive band.
Yeah.
So that was us.
Wow.
But we were progressive, but we also had proper songs. You know, we weren't just playing arrangements. We actually had songs. So that was Argent, and we went to Germany to get the band together and started 9 45-minute spots a night.
Crikey.
Which you're supposed to gasp. Well, it's like working down the mines,
yeah.
Only harder. This is what I always say. So you'd have 10, you get 10 minutes off. And but we looked upon it as being a learning curve.
Yes.
While we're playing, we're here 9 minutes. Yeah, but let's do it. And of course, we didn't know why we were there. If you see what I mean, we thought people were there for the music, but that wasn't the right time for that sort of thing. Music hadn't become sort of hip, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Certainly not in Germany. And so the bar would be packed with women of negotiable affection. And and so we were just, I think the Jewish word is the shills, who were brought in to bring the punters in for the girls.
Right.
So anyway, we enjoyed ourselves immensely, and it was hard work, but it was good hard work. And we went from there to straight to America, and then we sort of never stopped going to America.
Crikey.
And it is a pretty, it's not unbelievable, because it sort of happened to quite a few of my friends, that sort of thing. But everybody's got a story that sort of parallels that a little bit if they were successful. I mean, Chaz, for example, was going to America and doing all that stuff. We did an album with Chaz, and it was Ringo Starr was singing on it. I was playing drums, Russ Ballard was producing and playing guitar. And it was, we went to Sweet Silence, which is in Copenhagen, and there we are making an album, and I'm playing drums and Ringo isn't. It was very strange. So
bizarre.
That's the sort of thing that happened.
Yeah, almost surreal for you, isn't it? I mean, you were mentioning there about how, you know, the Argent thing came to you in a way, didn't it? And you had a similar experience, I believe, when you ended up playing for the Kinks, because you were playing solo drums for Dave Davies. And of course, Ray invited you in to join the Kinks. Am I right in that?
Well, you're very close, very, very close. Well done. What it is, I was playing in a rhythm and blues band with a load of pals, and it was called GB Blues Company, and there were 10 of us. So a lot of horns, everything was in this band. And we were making proper rhythm and blues music. And a guy called Root Jackson was the singer. It was just great. It was sublime. We didn't make any money because there were 10 of us, but you could work out how much money you weren't going to make. It was very simple, you know, easy to divide by 10.
Yes.
So anyway, we did loads of gigs, and we played at the Torrington, which you probably had never heard of, but it's in Finchley, and it was a great gig. It was a big pub, and everybody played there of a progressive nature. And we played there with GB Blues, and I looked out into the audience, and I thought, that looks like Ray Davies. Anyway, I got on with playing, didn't really give it too much thought. And after the gig, it turns out it was Ray. And he came over and he said, what are you doing at the moment? So I said, well, I'm whatever, you know, I'm doing this and I'm doing other stuff. He said, do you want to make a record with me? So I immediately said, what about Mick? And he said, Mick Avery.
Yeah.
And he said, who was my pal? You know, I didn't want to tread on his feet.
Of
but
course.
He said, oh, no, Mick's not doing this one. So I did the album, which went on. And eventually I was offered something, a tour with somebody. And somebody upmarket. And I phoned Ray and I said, Ray, are you finished with me in the studio? Because I've got a tour to do if I want. He said, you can't do a tour. You're in the Kinks.
Oh.
So that was how I learned I was in the Kinks. And he then said, we'll rehearse tomorrow and the next day, and then we're off to America. And I thought, when were you going to tell me this?
Oh, my goodness me.
Anyway, there's a lot of happenstances in my life. So off I went and we rehearsed. And on the first day, we rehearsed a load of numbers. And I meticulously wrote down everything so I wouldn't forget it.
Mm.
And the next day we went back to the studio. He said, let's do all the numbers again. And they had different intros and different endings.
Oh, no.
And I said, we didn't have this yesterday, Ray. He said, oh, no, we don't all do the same beginnings and the same endings. So I then realized that this was not, you know, the Kinks was not a drunken drummer's gig. You know, you had to be on all the time because you didn't know where he was going.
Oh.
If you were lucky, the list on the floor next to you was accurate, but often it wasn't. I mean, he read the audience, quite rightly so, and he would respond accordingly.
Oh,
so that was that went on for, I think, 12 years or something.
Goodness
and in
me.
The same way, I didn't know I was in the Kinks. I actually don't know. I'm not in the Kinks, other than there's no car coming round to pick me up.
So somewhere along the line, then, Bob, it just kind of ended, but you just still don't know.
Well, yeah. Well, that's the thing about bands. You know, they do just stop, but you don't know. Right, this is the last gig. You don't know that, but there is always a last gig.
There is somewhere, isn't there? But bands, as you say, are very organic, aren't they? I mean, you were almost in Genesis, I understand, in a similar kind of way, because you were obviously friends with Phil Collins at the time. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I knew Phil. I can't say that I knew him when he was a child actor, but I knew him reasonably. We would bump into each other, and he liked what I did, playing-wise. And I was ill. And half of an Argent album was made by me, and half of it was made by Phil, with the proviso, believe it or not, with the proviso that if I died, Phil would get the gig.
Oh, no.
So fortunately, neither of those came to pass. But we knew one another. He would sometimes turn up to Argent gigs, and we would bump into each other quite a bit, And so life went on, and this was when Peter Gabriel left. He said, Peter's leaving, he phoned me up, said, Peter's leaving the band. I don't know what to do. He said, I'm thinking I'm going to sing. So if I sing, do you want to come and play the drums? So now, this sounds ridiculous and everything. Why on earth wouldn't you join Genesis? Well, Phil didn't know what was going on. Nobody else knew that it was... You know, I mean, of course, it became hugely successful, but nobody knew that.
No.
And there were no plans. And you know, so anyway, I didn't do it. There were some contractual problems, too. And the thing about any musician, they'll tell you they missed out on some opportunities simply because you can't help it. And I mean, the adage is opportunities look much better looking back at them.
Hindsight's
rather
great.
Than looking forward at them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, 2020, of course. Yeah.
But you see, in between all these wonderful opportunities, and you've obviously played with some fabulous bands as well, but you've actually had some good session work as well, haven't you, with quite a lot of different kinds of musical styles. You've worked with the punk scene as well, as one extreme to Leo Sayer and Don McLean and Roger Daltrey. All sorts of opportunities there, really, which came your way.
Well, yes. I mean, the thing about being a musician, or let's say a drummer, I'm not saying drummers aren't musicians, but being a drummer is you've got to be versatile.
Mm.
You know, if somebody wants you to play in a certain style, you can't say, that's not my bag, man.
No.
If they've booked you, that's what you do. So I've because of Adam Faith, I'm very very malleable as far as music is concerned, and it's because of all the diverse music we had to play with Adam Faith. I mean, I actually did something for Lionel Bart for one of his shows and recorded this stuff, and it wasn't rock and roll by any manner of means, because apart from Living Doll, he didn't do rock and roll, that's for sure, you know. He did Oliver, that's what he does, you know, so it was all that sort of thing. And that, so that was one end, and the other end is probably punk along the lines of, I had a drum shop called Drum Store, which was in, it was in Wardour Street.
Yeah.
And it was about 50 yards along Wardour Street from the Marquee. And every now and again, we would get somebody coming from the Marquee saying, are there any drummers here? And we would laugh and say, yeah, this is a drum shop. We're all drummers. Well, can anybody come and do this, do a session for us? And we say, why, what's wrong? And the producer would be ready to pull his head off, because punks didn't want to do more than one take. You know, we obviously dyed-in-the-wool musicians will keep going. There was one Argent track that I know we did 51 takes off. So, you know, that's what you've got to be capable of doing.
Yeah.
But punks didn't want to do that. So I would rush along, or one of the guys would rush along, and we'd do the session. And we'd do it as many times as they wanted it. And we'd play as loud as they wanted it. And we'd play it as vigorously as they wanted it. And that's what we did. I have no idea who I played with, because...
they came and went.
How can I put that? I'm not going to say what I'm going to say, but you know, they were. I mean, I see Rat Scabies quite a bit, and I see a lot of those drummers from having had the drum shop. But the problem was, punks never wanted to pay any money.
Yeah.
They would come in and say, "Got any second-hand drumsticks?" or "Got any second-hand heads?" And we'd say, "Well, no, we've got this new stuff we sell." And they would say, "Well, we ain't got any money." And of course, that was their excuse.
Oh,
so that was the drum shop era,
amazing.
And which was great fun while it lasted. And every now and again, I wake up thinking, you know what, I'd like to have a drum shop again. And then I go back to sleep.
Yes, you think perhaps not.
As quickly as I can. Yeah, best not. Yeah.
Best not.
Well, the thing about music shops is that. I don't know where your nearest one is, but they are becoming few and far between.
They are indeed, aren't they? I mean, the music industry has changed quite a bit. But I think it's interesting what you're saying there about musical styles and your versatility as a drummer. And I suspect that's probably why in 92 you actually received an Ivor Novello Award, didn't you, for services to music?
I did.
How did that feel? That was incredible.
It was good. I was with the guys, Ray and Dave and the rest of the band, and they gave me one of those statuettes, which, interestingly enough, I mean, I don't think I'm worthy, but I've got it, and I'm looking at it now, and it's easy for me to say.
Quite surreal, really.
So, I mean, adulation is good. Well, anything that marks what you've done in the music industry is always very acceptable, because we're all showing off. That's what gets you into music in the first place. The second thing is to meet the opposite sex, or it was in those days.
Yes.
And the third is for adulation.
Yeah, and of course you know as a member of the Kinks, you've been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as well. So I guess that does mark a pivotal point, doesn't it, in a career, saying, do you know what, I've actually done quite well.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's not until you start writing an autobiography that you realise how much you've crammed in.
Yeah.
And I've sort of managed to keep going, which is good.
That's brilliant. And of course, your autobiography came out in 2014. That was called Banging On, wasn't it? And I'm no doubt that
Banging On, yeah.
And a lot of people will probably want to buy that, I'm sure, after listening to this interview with you.
Oh, it's on Amazon.
Brilliant. And you referred earlier to On the Road Again, which is your touring days, wasn't it?
I'm not quite sure what to call it, but it's a touring diary, and it's about all the places that we went to. I mean, just to encapsulate it, I would be with Don McLean going through Wyoming on a bus, for example. There would be, if you looked out the front window, there was a horizon and a road going ever on. If you looked out the back window, there was a horizon and the road going ever back. Looked to the side, there was a horizon. Looked to the left, there was another horizon. There was nothing to see, but it didn't stop me looking. And I always expected, like in North by Northwest, that a plane would land, you know, on the road in front of us, and an adventure would happen. But anyway, I began to write everything down. Well, I've always written things down, and so that is on the road again. Problem is, all these things take time.
They do.
You know, you can't think, I'm going to write a book and just, well, certainly not a second, third, or fourth book, because they take time. And of course, once you've done the first one, you know exactly how much time they do take. I've got a writing partner now for the technical stuff I'm writing, and that works rather well because he can do what I can't do and vice versa. So it is a way forward. The problem is that I have probably four books on my computer that are half finished, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
So I'm not sure when I'm going to get to them. One of them is the obligatory novel that we've all got in us, evidently. Mm. Well, you just try getting it out and try finding the time to get it out. And I'm working on children's stories because I read so many things to my granddaughters that I figure I can do this. Yeah. I can do it anyway.
Wow.
It's onwards and upwards regardless, really.
It certainly is, isn't it? And what an absolutely wonderful career that you've had and you are still having, which is wonderful because it's, you know, for so many years in the business, it's hard to sustain that, isn't it? So I wish you all the best on that. And I do hope that people go out and buy your books because there's some fascinating stories in there, some of which you've touched upon today. And I'm sure there's many, many more. We could be sitting here all day talking, Bob, I feel.
We'd need another cup of tea.
Yeah, we certainly would, wouldn't we?
at least another cup of tea. Very welcome. I'm good at talking about me. I do something called Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. And I try it's an after dinner type speech. And I try to do it at ladies' golf clubs and things like that. And they, of course, love the idea because it's a sex and drugs and rock and roll. I mean, it's just a catch-all.
Yeah.
There is no sex in it. But at the end of it, I will say, Madam Chairman or the Lady Captain, I've run out of time. And I know the Lady Captain was very interested in the sex side of my conversation. But we've run out of time, so you'll have to invite me back. And, of course, everybody loves that you would think that some straight lady was interested in the sex side of rock and roll.
But do you know what? She probably is.
Well, of course, yeah. Well, yeah.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And I do hope that we actually get to meet face-to-face at some point, because I'm sure that we'd have an absolute riot. But I thank you so much for your time. It's been absolutely wonderful. And let's catch up soon again.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cat Tales. To listen again to this and other tales, go to cattales.co.uk.